We will now move to parallel session 8, as originally scheduled, on social capital and sustainable development. Forgive me, my name is Peter Lord, and I'm not Dr. Anthony George. I'm just filling in. And we will have Ms. Marisa Wilson from the University of the West Indies, Trinidad and Tobago, to talk about the commitment and identifying formation in the Caribbean food system towards a new model for social capital. Ms. Wilson.
Thank you. It's actually identifying, it should be identity formation, I believe, but then I changed the title again. But I'm going to shift gears a little bit. I'm going to give you guys a break, your eyes a break. I'm going to give your left side of your brain a break, because I'm going to focus more on qualitative issues. So I don't think that a PowerPoint will really be helpful in that, so I'm planning on not doing a PowerPoint. My argument is basically a critique of this neoliberal model of social capital, okay, which seems to equate economic action or maximizing individual human action, individual humans is the focus. It equates that with a more social aspects of life, okay? So it's something that's more collective. It's treating the two as commensurable, and I'm going to break that down, okay? It is a theoretical argument, but it does have practical and real-life implications, as I think that we all are aware of the controversy, the moral outrage that happened when a certain prime minister made comments that equated trade and aid, for example. Okay. So there are some implications, but I apologize for the theoretical slant. If the idea of social capital in economics is a process, then it is a very specific one. Indeed, some may even argue that the very expression social capital is a contradiction in terms. While capital implies a link between human and object, or in the case of derivatives, imaginary objects, the origins of the word social, to follow, involve human-to-human relations. As with any normative interpretation of social behavior, economic concepts such as social capital emphasize and actively shape certain aspects of social reality to the exclusion of others. This kind of categorical switching from theory to practice has significant implications for the present and future state of rural Caribbean communities in the Caribbean and rural development elsewhere. A purely utilitarian understanding of social networks may, for example, lead to policies that reinforce existing patterns of optimizing behavior instead of policies that further the livelihoods and locally defined well-being of rural Caribbean and other communities. Most theorists of social forms of capital and economics, at least those on the utilitarian side, treat the social as a mere appendage to fixed economic transactions between maximizing individuals. Indeed, far from drawing from the long history of insights and analytical tools established by other social scientists, dominant views of social capital and economics, such as that upheld by Nobel Prize-winning economist Gary Becker, ignore all motivations for socioeconomic behavior that stray from the realm of self-interest. Moreover, formal models that aim to describe the relation between economics and society perpetuate their own existence by ensuring a kind of bounded and universal consistency. Being politically oriented, they establish normative frameworks with real-life implications. One extremely utilitarian account of social capital is Gary Becker's approach, which one might see as an extension of his human capital theory in the New Household Economics. While Becker's work on the various humanized capitals may be the apex of economic abstraction, it is relevant for our purpose because Becker himself spearheaded the general shift in economics away from a purely purely economic domain and towards more non-economic or social domains. In contrast to Amartya Sen's theory of commitment, to which I will soon return, Becker sees no instances where higher order or meta rankings of economic decision making are either necessary or useful in understanding behavior, since ethics and culture, and I quote, affect behavior in the same general way as do other determinants of utility and preferences, end quote. In this view, maximizing individual levels of consumption, whether in the form of financial capital or commodities, is the sole motivation for economic decision-making. Social motivations, which may not depend on optimizing personal consumption, are left out. In Sen's terms, quote, a person is given one preference ordering, that of maximizing his self-interest, and as and when the need arises, this is supposed to reflect his interests, represent his welfare, summarize his idea of what should be done, and describe his actual choices and behavior. Can one preference ordering do all of these things? The purely economic man is indeed close to being a social moron, end quote. In addition to treating the universal individual in his social context as exogenous to the economic process, Becker draws a parallel between stocks of social capital and all other forms of physical and economic capital. Indeed, Becker treats social capital in the same way as any other tangible commodity, to be added and subtracted to one's personal assets based on his or her preferences. In terms of the Caribbean food system, this means that forms of physical capital, such as land and machinery, are placed in the same light as forms of social capital, such as agribusiness skills and connections, or indeed work motivation. If all social and economic forms are treated equally as capital transacted between individuals, however, then it is just one more logical step to reason that persons with claims to social capital start on a level playing ground, competing in synchronic horizontal networks that extend throughout space, as the idea of a net would imply. Imbalances of power hindering local and regional food security, which have developed over time, then become irrelevant to socioeconomic analysis. Confining the model to economic valuations also leaves unearthed ecological considerations. Indeed, the constant degradation and downgrading of prime agricultural land to residential or industrial districts in places like Trinidad is a trend beset by the very motivations this kind of economic analysis encourages. Such exclusions are not only a matter of epistemology, but also of hegemony. The issue of most concern with universalizing concepts such as social capital is not that they are based on a single preference ordering, the maximization of personal welfare. In a neoliberal world, this is certainly the primary motivation for many exchanges, social or otherwise. It is rather that they place all social transactions into this light, relegating other relations among humans and between humans and things, such as environments, to the realm of irrelevant, immeasurable darkness. Such perspectives not only obscure political, economic, ecological, and social realities embedded in long-term social relations, but also rest on the imposing ground of prescriptive model-making. In time and with paradigmatic and authoritative rigor, the theoretical model of reality becomes a substantive model or blueprint for reality. The dominant account is then reified to the point that micro-actors, such as small farmers, sometimes lose the ability to determine and decide upon alternative paths of action. But there are, as always, exceptions to the rule. One is the perspective of Nobel Prize-winning economist Amartya Sen on the interface between society and economics. This draws from Bernard Williams' work on the inseparability between personal from social identities. Both theorists argue that rules and norms for social identification have an intrinsic, non-instrumental value, which provides the base on which personal identities are built. In practical terms, this means that a farmer's decision to, say, sell his produce to a particular vendor may be based more on a shared identity, such as familial relations, than on the farmer's desire to maximize his profit. Sometimes. I mean, often people also think about profit, but there are other aspects. Sen's idea of commitment and related analyses of identity formation may fortify the oft unstable bridge linking formal economic thought to more qualitative fields such as anthropology. And anthropology, in particular, has much to offer as it aims to link theory to ethnographic and historical contexts, revealing how shared values become socially and thus personally important through long-term social processes. If one draws from anthropology to explain real-life economic decision-making, the implications of non-instrumental, transcendental values become clear. In rural Cuba, where I conducted ethnographic fieldwork in 2007, the food system is linked not only to a global market driven by individual preferences and rules of supply and demand, but also to a national value system, the product of Cuba's particular political and intellectual history. Indeed, while Cubans have partly incorporated the consumerist culture of their northern neighbor, they are also influenced by ideas that have shaped Cuban society over time. One way to demonstrate this point is to consider work motivation in the Cuban agricultural sector. While economists such as Becker would make a direct link between work motivation and labor-intensive activities such as agriculture, on one hand, and individual remuneration, on the other, I suggest that such factors only tell part of the story. Becker comments specifically on communist forms of economic organization, claiming that, quote, every communist regime, regardless of culture, failed to achieve any lasting reorientation. Since pay was not sensitive to how hard people worked, they invariably chose to work little, no matter what culture, end quote. In the remaining part of this paper, I dispute this claim with ethnographic data that brings Sen's idea of commitment into the analytical toolkit. A convenient place to start is the normative view of work in Cuba. With the slogan, from each according to his needs to each according to his ability, the official account of work is tied to social values, one of which is commitment to the Cuban nation. As in other post-Soviet places, work in Cuba has a kind of transactional value, which opens up opportunities for benefits such as land acquisition. One of the most dedicated farmers I met, Eduardo, had volunteered for construction brigades of the 1970s and 80s and helped to build many of the houses presently resided in by agronomists from the nearby university. Eduardo's efforts certainly helped his chances of obtaining land during the most recent land reforms of the past two decades, as well as support from the university, such as access to information and bio-inputs. But it was not just communist norms that prompted Eduardo and his family to prefer social over monetary transactions. His wife, Mariela, made this aspect of their farming business most clear when she expressed her anger with a woman who had come to the house to buy produce. While the woman who visited could have brought milk from her family's goat as a gift to Eduardo's family, which would have been exchanged for produce, the woman was stupid, and I quote, since she only brought money. Mariela stressed they always preferred to help others with what they produced and were happy when people brought items of use to the family. In her terms, quote, it is not money, it is the feeling one gets when you're knowing that you're helping someone. She concluded her complaint about the woman on a metaphorical note. Quote, one hand washes the other, but the two together can wash the face. Though Eduardo did engage in market transactions and selling produce to visitors, like his wife, he preferred personalized exchanges, usually in kind, conducted on the farm to monetary exchanges. He claimed that his farm was more successful because of these exchange relationships, which combined market and non-market or barter transactions. As with rewards reaped for household work, the benefits from economic activities based on long-term commitments to people and place are not always commensurable with monetary or capital returns, lying as they do within the domain of economic externalities, such as the environment or collective well-being. The very act of equating economic value with all social values has real-life consequences, as rich markets embedded in local communities shift to thinner, more impersonal transactions. If fields such as anthropology are to truly influence economics and development, it must be understood that market values do not and cannot entirely replace the who, the what, and the where of long-term social processes. So what does this mean for the use of social capital to ensure food security in the Caribbean? To start with, it means that the drive to do agricultural work, even in non-communist societies, is not always based on economic motivations alone, especially for people who have developed a sense of commitment to land and community. It also means that the dominant idea of social capital may hinder rather than help our understanding of how such social processes work on the ground. But of course, just as Putnam cannot recreate the era of American civic society, neither can we reorder the structure of Caribbean history, characterized as it is by reconstituted peasants, who may associate agricultural work and local produce with a fractured colonial past. At present, people are trying to relink Caribbean people and places by promoting regional identity through economic unity. I have tried, however, to show that identification processes are complex and situated, and so economic unification can never mean total social unification. Given the historical and hegemonic shifts away from agriculture and towards modern industry, it is hard to know how one may begin to reestablish commitment as a basis for economic activity within the food system. First, we may work to prevent cases like the closure of Caroni in Trinidad, where farmers and local consumers alike had already established commitments to place and community, to recur. Indeed, we must recognize the role of commitment in the Caribbean food system, from the social and ecological relations a farmer has to his land and community, to the way that people value commodities. To do so, we may, for example, encourage those efforts that are already being done in educating the public about local foods and their uses. If we are to realign the social, environmental, and political economic aspects of land, people, and production in the Caribbean, a revolution in paradigms is surely needed. Indeed, as I've tried to show in this paper, models for society that rely primarily on maximizing motivations are as inadequate as they are unjust. Thank you.
Thank you, Marisa. Any questions? Marisa? Yes, sir.
I think we need to start from the ground up, really. It's important to have people like social scientists go and talk to people and find out whether, I'm not saying that sugar perhaps in the Caroni situation was the right way forward, but because the people were actually producing other agricultural commodities and they had lived there and they had established connections already and created a kind of food security situation in that area, at least, it's important to be aware of what's going on the ground before you take steps to eliminate communities that are already there, okay?
Any other questions? Yes?
Without understanding the process. And I think that is what you much of what she's saying, that we are dealing with every yes, we are interconnected, but with that, the policy in that which is much better. I recognize if most time is done without public, without the public, the best way to go. And somewhere in the thinking, then, technocrats created this. It is almost geared towards urban, able bodies,
Well, it's an American model, isn't it?
But nobody knows where you want to generate that money.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have all these social issues competing,
mm-hmm.
agriculture is not on, how do you make agriculture in the
But we've been following, I mean, except for the prominent Caribbean theorists, you know, they were never, it was always Sir Arthur Lewis instead, you know, it was outside economists, right? Now it's Chicago economists. And that is a hegemony that has been created. I'm not trying to say, and I don't want to slip into the middle class argument that everybody's all equal. We need to take away this idea that profit is important and all of that, because profit is important. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is there are other angles that are eclipsed when we focus with just this telescopic view that we're given from the outside. Okay. It is a social construct. That's what I'm trying to indicate, yeah. But everybody's doing that in the the first world. That's what they're doing. They've created all these niche markets for going back to the land. But I have a suggestion which I've written into policy now. Hopefully, it's actually going to be accepted. That make the markets a fun place to go, exciting, modern. Make agriculture more exciting. There are already people that are getting their fingers dirty. Let's not hinder them anymore. They've been punched in the face so much over the past couple, you know, there has always been a Caribbean peasant, right? And they've always struggled. There's always been people on the land. There's more. I think that small farmers make up most of the food production still in the world, but they don't have the kinds of tools. And the perception of consumers is that if you go to a market in Trinidad, it's dirty. You know, I talk to consumers, especially youth. They want to go and have packaged things from the supermarket, and not everyone, but some people feel. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't think all publishers are doing it, but it's something that they're working on. And
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's great. I mean, but if you go to a place like, I'm saying, San Francisco market, right? It's a wonderland. There are all these other things to do besides buy produce. You can sample things. It's fun. People go for fun. It's a leisure activity, actually, to spend time. And if we can reverse the idea that agriculture, local stuff, is not modern, not, you know, and re-evaluate what modern is, then perhaps we have, you know, there's a chance.
Just go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. No. Yeah. Of course. But of course. Yeah.
And then the small farmers, they get together as a cooperative, they get together as a group. As crops here, as a there was a food shortage, and then we talk about food security. And then we did a big holiday. And the areas come out of it.
Yeah.
And then we did a new prime minister, the former prime minister, that had a collaboration and they started planning. And then a new regime came in to follow and Of course, it's easy to talk about it in an air-conditioned room, and you know, and I understand. Yeah. What I remarked was the president's white Mm-hmm. However, instead of just attacking all fat people to make them feel worse about themselves like they already might, mm-hmm. she didn't go there.
Yeah.
Besides modeling it herself of exercise and eating right, she brought in children from the projects who would never have seen inside White House mm-hmm. and the grounds to plant. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they came and saw that as a project. Mm-hmm. When the plants were ready to be bearing the fruit and probably she brought them back in to harvest. Mm-hmm. What happened, and I don't even believe it was an intention, but it was like an unintended consequence. When they now began to depend the amount of fruit that came out from the plant, there were wheelbarrows of fruit, which they now took to shelters where non-profit. Mm-hmm. So they removed that for profit. Mm-hmm. Took it to where there are other needy, vulnerable groups. Mm-hmm. And then what was a spin was that these children, who even the average American kid does not like vegetables, they started eating vegetables. Mm-hmm. And not only that, when their parents were preparing it in the kitchen, they are telling their mothers not so much grease and sugar.
Yeah.
Because this is what they grew.
Yeah. The taste of it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course. It's changing the values. Of course.
So it is like we have to be able to look and see where to send that scatter shot.
Mm-hmm.
Like the years. So that yeah. when they hit that ball, it will hit several others.
Mm-hmm.
So the key is finding the issue. Because social capital is an oxymoron.
Mm-hmm. That's
social
what I'm trying to say. Yeah.
Moments,
mm-hmm.
But that's
mm-hmm.
But last but not least, what I tell some of my students is don't ever leave out Hobbesian theory.
Mm-hmm.
Because Hobbes is driving economics.
Mm-hmm.
We are evil, inherently nasty.
Of course, yeah.
And has gone down quick creek.
Yeah.
So as a result, you're out there of fear in your own shadow.
Yeah.
So that if, as regards our trying to say, get rich quick or die while crying. Mm-hmm. So all of that is factored in.
Yeah.
The moving from Hobbes to Locke, it mm-hmm. says, oh, you know, there's mm-hmm. a higher order.
Mm-hmm.
We can all have, if we share a little more, we can all have plenty. There's not any lack or mm-hmm. scarcity. It is just a few have at the expense of many.
Mm-hmm.
You know
okay.
Yeah.
So when the shift, as I talk about the tectonic shift,
mm-hmm.
the shift from Hobbes to Locke.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. I've been getting a lot of signals that we need to move on. But this is rich, though. This is rich.
Okay. Can I just make a statement?
Sure.
Just to say that. I think that that's a good way to say it. I mean, this, I can critique this whole thing because it's, you know, you're all in academic theory. You need to get back down on the ground, and I understand that. We can talk about practical stuff like the fact that, you know, Trinidad and Tobago only spent $1.8 billion TT dollars as a, you know, and $44 billion budget, whereas the U.S. spends a much higher percentage on subsidies and all that. We could talk about the practical issues, like there are some food barons who are, you know, an underhandedness in the food system, paying off people for imports. And we can talk about practical issues like the IMF conditionalities that require imports from the US. All of these things are important to discuss. Yeah,
just to add one bit to finish up, what you were talking about, the urgency and now, that is one of the underlying problems in our performance in cricket. We can't take that 5D thing, because basketball is here. See, yeah? It also is one of the causes for urban drift in the small Caribbean islands. And it's also, you see, underneath all of that is the influence of a dominant culture called North America. Everything is now. And everything is now in front of us, right in front of us. We don't have to take 5 days for a letter to get here. It's right in front of us. So our aspirations and our reality, there's a big gap. All right. For you, it'll be interesting to see what the farmer wife says when Cuba is opened up and it faces the North American onslaught. It'll be interesting to see what she says if they bring a thing of milk instead of a green dollar.
All right. We have to move on. Thank you very much. We're now going to have the topic of Patterns of Caribbean Livelihoods by Corinne Gregoire of Cipriani College of Labor and Cooperative Studies in Trinidad and Tobago. Ms. Gregoire.
Good evening again. Just to give you a preamble of what this is about. At the master's level, I was exposed to a project where we looked at four OECS countries trying to build or to establish a relationship between poverty and the environment. And inside of there, we got to see what the livelihoods of the Caribbean people would look like. So this paper now is a drill down from the poverty and environment relationship, which we could establish but couldn't measure very well, but we're drilling down that now to see what is the dominant pattern of our Caribbean livelihood and how can we now make changes towards it to make it more sustainable. So what I intend to do now, I'm going to highlight some of the livelihood issues within the Caribbean. The study is supposed to build a body of knowledge that can contribute to sustainable livelihoods within the Caribbean. And for this afternoon, we're going to look at this in the context of two Caribbean islands, particularly from the OECS, St. Vincent and the Grenadines and Grenada. We're going to introduce the concept. We're going to look at the sustainable livelihood approach based from two different organizations, although there are many who would have looked at it. We're going to look at DFID and IFAD, and then we're going to apply the sustainable livelihood approach, first taking a macroeconomic overview. I will come to that. It's IFAD, but I will come to that and give you the explanation of the model as we go on through. I will give you a macroeconomic overview of the both countries and then take one from an agrarian standpoint and then the other from a marine and fishery standpoint and then conclude. So first, what is sustainable livelihood? It has been introduced by the Brundtland Commission on Environment and Development and really began as an approach to enhance resource productivity. We wanted to secure ownership of assets and see how the stocks and flows moves, and we really wanted to know that what was the problem with food security. We're saying it's more a problem of poverty and the different directions and the explanations we could get when we started to define poverty. So the United Nations on Environment, the United Nations Commission for Environment and Development initiated the first expansion in the context of Agenda 21. And they're saying that to achieve sustainable livelihood, we need to focus on three main areas: development, sustainable resource management, and poverty eradication. But we must do these things simultaneously. Now, they are only the first set of people who try to expand this. We have one major set of people who would have contributed to the definitions. They were in the first set, but they still, up to today, are founders and main contributors to the definition. So we're going to go through to make sure we get what they would have contributed. For them, that's Chambers and Conway 1992, and in some cases, we could probably dispute 1991. A livelihood, in its simplest sense, is a means of gaining a living. A livelihood comprises the capabilities, assets, stores, resources, claims and access, and activities required for a means of a living. A livelihood becomes sustainable when it can cope with and recover from the stresses and shocks, maintain or enhance its capabilities and assets, and provide sustainable livelihood opportunities for the next generation, and which contributes net benefits to other livelihoods at the local and global levels in the short and in the long term. Now that is quite a mouthful. But they are not the only people who have contributed. Many, many authors have put together and contributed to the definition, including some of our own Caribbean people, Pantin et al., 2004. But from all of this, what are the main points that come from a definition or come from the term sustainable livelihoods? It's derived from a wider set of issues, firstly. We're talking an intergenerational component, future generations and present generations. We're looking at natural resource usage. How do we use our resources to make the best use now and for the future? How are we linking this to poverty, and how do we use our institutions and processes to now build a livelihood? As I said when I started off, it includes the wider debate of poverty and the environment. And this is a drill down because we have established that that relationship exists in the Caribbean and that your environment does in fact make you poor. It draws on the elements where we could look at trade-offs, because if we want to achieve poverty, if we want to move beyond poverty, we're going to have to trade off something else to move beyond poverty. So equitability and sustainability arise into the components as well. And lastly, this definition has to be subject to negotiation. If you want to talk about people's livelihood, it must be contextualized to the situation that you are going to be in. So we have to leave things to be recognized, things to be tweaked to however we want to interpret what our livelihood and what we mean by sustainable livelihood. So the sustainable livelihood is going to be an approach. It's going to be in a way of thinking. How do we put together our priorities for development? It's going to be evolutionary rather than revolutionary. We are not going to be able to say, well, A is going to be attributed to sustainable livelihoods. Sometimes good development practice can lead us to achieving a sustainable livelihood. It's going to be an analytical framework or probably even a planning tool with which we can use. And now I get to what you're asking me about the definitions, because many people would have put together, or many different organizations would have come up with what a sustainable livelihood could be. We have the United Nations Development Programme contributing, the Cooperative for Assistance and Relief, the Department for International Development, the Oxford Committee for Farming Relief, the International Fund for Agricultural Development, that's IFAD, and from the Department of Land Affairs in South Africa and the Danish Funding Agency, we have the Policy Guidelines for Integrating Environmental Policy and the Learning About Livelihoods approach. Now, what are the basic features that all of these people would have said? How do we make sense of all of this information we have to know what is the crux of the matters, we should say? The focus is going to be on the livelihoods of the poor. It's going to reject the one-sector approach. You can't try to build a livelihood that's sustainable by focusing on agriculture alone. You have to take into account all the elements, but we need to first determine an entry point. And we're going to place some emphasis on involving the people in the identification and implementation, because if we want to talk about a person's livelihood, we have to find out what is important to them. So for the purpose of this paper, I'm only going to go through two of the models that we've explained so far. That's the DFID model and the IFAD model. So the DFID model is more of a framework. And now the framework is just a way that we can try to put or to explain our reality. It's going to define and categorize the type of assets and the entitlements which households have and how we're going to use those assets to build our livelihood. It's going to look at the connections, the macro-micro linkages, and how they work together with the processes and the institutions to which people have exposure to then build a livelihood. The framework is going to give us a checklist of the important issues, and it's going to outline ways that these issues are going to be linked to each other. It's going to draw some attention to the influences and the processes, and it's going to look at the different interactions to make a livelihood at the end. The framework is not going to give us a whole list of issues which we must consider, because again, a livelihood is dependent and contextualized to the people and the area in which it is going to be built in. It's not going to work in a linear manner. We can't say, well, if you get up one morning and feel to go to work and then you work all day, you will make some money. It's not going to be like that. It's not going to work in a linear manner at all. And the framework is not going to be an exact model of reality, and it's not going to define poverty for us. Because when you look to define poverty, poverty can be a state, it can be a process. All of that we need to take into consideration. That's why this thing needs to be so contextualized. What the framework is now, it is going to be a planning and assessment tool. It's going to help us build the analytical structure to consider livelihood and what is important for each person to build a livelihood. So now let's look at what this framework is going to do for us. It's going to first start off with a vulnerability context. It's going to show us the shocks, the seasonalities, the trends and the changes, and how that affects the individual. It's going to consider the main elements of capital: human, social, natural, physical, financial capital. And now we're going to see how these influence the policies, the processes, and the institutions, which determine the livelihood strategies that you choose, and then the livelihood outcome that you have. Now we're getting into IFAD. Now, IFAD model is going to be more of a challenge to DFID model, because DFID is the conventional model. IFAD is saying, well, we have some problems with your model, and these are the changes we want to make your model work. this is the model that the development practitioners say is going to work better, so we are going to make some changes to our existing model. So first, because I showed you in the last diagram, the model would move from one point to the next, we are going to take away that and we're going to make it less sequential. We're going to rearrange the framework. We're going to put the people at the center of the diagram, and particularly the people whose livelihood are most at risk. We're going to put the poor at the center of the diagram and then build outwards. We are going to unpack the policies, processes, and institutions box, because in that case, we have to know how our policies are going to affect people and what are the institutions doing when they put together a policy. Who are they consulting? So we're going to unpack that level into two main areas, the service delivery and the enabling agencies. And it's going to focus on institutions, their roles, and the mixes with the relationships with the poor. How do the institutions affect the poor? So let's have a look at what this model is now going to look like. We start off with the poor in the middle. We have the factors, the human factors that's going to make up who we are. Then we're going to include our capital, different forms, but in here we want to include personal capital inside of there, because when you decide to do something, we have to look at your internal motivations. What are you willing to do? What would motivate you to be a political leader? What will make you motivate you to be a priest? What will motivate you to do what you want to do? So we have to look at all the characteristics that make up you. So this is an addition that wasn't there in the DFID model. Then we're going to look at the markets, the politics, the culture, and the rights. And then that's going to form our aspirations and show us where our opportunities lie. When we put that into the context of the vulnerability, and then from that now, our actions and then our outcomes. So now, this is a nice theoretical model. Let's put this thing to work. Let's get two case studies that we can look at to see if this thing can be used by us in any way at all. So what I did from the studies of poverty and the environment, we would have been exposed to four OECS countries. So I'm choosing only two so that we can get an idea of how we build our livelihoods in the Caribbean, and can we hint any way to saying that our livelihood is sustainable or not sustainable. So St. Vincent and the Grenadines, well, now this is mainly for the people who are not from the Caribbean, and if we want to get some more data inside of there. St. Vincent and the Grenadines is a small open economy with 15 political constituencies, including the Grenadine Islands. The population is 113,000 as of about 2005, and I believe it's not past 120 by now. The land space is 390 square kilometers. The growth rate is 1% per year. About half of the country we consider to be urban. The next half we could say it is rural. Life expectancy is 72.3 years, and agriculture is the mainstay of the economy. So our definition and our livelihood structure is going to be highly tied to agriculture, as we were just noting. What we're saying, agriculture, construction, wholesale, and retail is going to make up the main revenue earners for the sector, or for the employment sector. And we have approximately 21% of the population being unemployed, while the labor force is 59.4%. The island is going to be extremely vulnerable to shocks, and because they are on the hurricane belt, and because they also have a volcano on the island. So now let us get inside of here now. This is the interesting part. I had the opportunity to go to St. Vincent and to get in to speak with some farmers, because we really want to test this theory and see how our livelihood is built. So Byron now is a hilly community in the northern windward side of St. Vincent, and they're a farming community planting mainly bananas since the 1960s. Now, with the bananas, I'm asking them a couple of questions so they can talk to me and we can get a feel of how this thing goes. The bananas, everything that they produce is going to be sold. They produce between 40 to 60 boxes of bananas, and that would give them about $1,600 per month. Now, they have some costs inside of there. They're going to be paying between $40 to $50 per day for labor, and they have to apply fertilizers, chemicals, use strings, get bags, and transport their material. And when they go to sell their material, you get $18 on the fair trade market and $13 on the regional market, and you do this every 2 weeks. Now, the number of farmers in the area would have declined significantly. They're giving me figures. Now, the figures I'm quoting for the number of farmers is coming from WINFA, that's the Windward Island Farmers Association. 8,000 initially or way back, and now we have 1,200 farmers. The farmers are saying that they have problems with the costing that's going to be there to produce their material, and then they're having problems with the weather and the climate, the climatic changes. So now what are the livelihood issues we are seeing inside of there? As we saw this morning with the video, seasonality affects them to a great extent. They have little control over their natural resources because they just have access to the land area with which they are using and nothing else. So, and the strategies that they are using are going to be consistent. If I can help another farmer out when they are sick or when they need to reap their harvest, I can help lower the labor costs. So in this case, what I'm seeing coming out here is an issue of natural resource dependence. The farmers are now dependent on the natural resources to maintain their livelihoods. And what we have a particular problem coming from them is that the Banana Growers Association and Winford, they would get policies as to how these farmers can plant, the frequency with which they can put fertilizers into their plants, how close you can plant to the water source, etc. And now we're trying to achieve environmental sustainability, but forgetting that there are other levels of sustainability that will lead us to achieving a sustainable livelihood. We must consider the economic, the institutional, and the social. And as such, some of these farmers have moved away from planting the bananas towards planting marijuana, which will now give them a higher level of income. So now we're going to take quickly a macroeconomic overview of Grenada. So if you can just get the main things inside of here. The land area is 344 square feet, approximately about 100,000 people. The growth rate, again, is 1% per year. Again, with Grenada, the manufacturing industries are going to be small, and again, the agriculture is the main driving factor of the industry. But in this case, I wanted to slant it. We want to look at a marine and fishery standpoint, because inside of here, we have to consider not only the agricultural, but the extractive, and in this case, we want to go to the fisheries of the marine people. So I had another colleague who went into Subis in Grenada, and he would have gotten some information. So this would have been focusing on the aftermath after Hurricane Ivan and Emily in 2004 and 2005. And what they're saying there is that when they have a hurricane coming to hit them, sometimes it takes them between 2 months to 18 months to get back out there to start earning a living again. So you have a period of time where you have no money and your livelihood has been snatched away from you. So how do I now try to build a livelihood when my main source is now gone? So I will just kind of slip through this because the main issue again here is natural resource dependence. You are working towards an extractive type of livelihood, but if we have any climatic changes, we are under some pressure. So our conclusion from this is that we want to achieve a livelihood that's going to be sustainable. We want to be able to live comfortably even though we may have a hurricane or even though we may have an external shock, because hurricanes are only one type of shocks that we can have. We can have macroeconomic shocks now as we are the world is in a global recession. So what we want to focus on now is the three main areas: poverty, sustainable resource management, and development. And in this case, I want to stress more sustainable resource management and particularly access and management of, because we are so dependent on our natural environment. So our plan of action, we must develop quickly a plan of action towards making our livelihoods more sustainable. Otherwise, when a hurricane comes or a shock comes to us, we are now going to be unable to cope once again. Thank you.
Thank you, Corinne. As you may have noticed, I've been getting many calls to end the session. So I don't know if we have any questions. Let's make it very brief. If not, we move to the next session. I take it we move to the next session. All right. Thank you very much.